This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
The title of the book, The Art of Blissful Parenting, Teaching Your Children How to Follow Their Internal Guidance. And the author is Sharon Ballantyne, and Sharon joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. And this interview is brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Sharon.
Hello, Steve. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Great to have you with us. We're going to learn a lot, everyone, from Sharon. Not only has she written this great book, she is also a parent and been down the road. She knows what she's talking about. So, Sharon, tell us, first of all, we all struggle. We think we know what's best for our kids. We want to control them often, and that never seems to go too well, does it?
No, it really doesn't, Steve. It never helps to control our kids. You know, I think we've all tried it, no matter what kind of parent we see ourselves as. We want the best for our kids. And because we have the life experience, we think that we know the best for them. But any parent who's tried to control their children knows the resistance that's encountered, you know, the pushing back. So it's never any fun for anyone. Nope. We've all tried it. It's overrated for sure.
Before we get into the details of what you call our internal guidance system, tell us a little bit about your background. You now are a life coach, a parenting coach, you even are the founder of the Ballantyne Parenting Institute. But how did this all come about, Sharon? How did this all develop? And what's the reason you finally decided to write the book?
Well, Steve, I always felt like I needed to be or wanted to be the best parent possible. You know, my three children are now grown, they're adults, but it was always a passion being a parent. It was always kind of an innate feeling that I wanted to do the best and be the best. And, you know, it didn't always work out that way. You know, I did everything I thought I should do with them, and you know, some of the controlling aspects I delved into just didn't work out very well. And after coming full circle in with my parenting on teaching the children, you know, how to live their best life, and then forgetting what I knew and had taught them because of my fear when they entered their teen years, and then coming full circle again, helped me to really see that I had a message for parents, that I really could write a book to help them, you know, avoid a lot of the problems that I had caused for myself in my parenting.
Tell us about the aha moment that you had with your son.
Oh, it was such a great moment. We will always talk and now laugh about that moment. It was the day at age 14 when I gave my son Dustin his life back on a silver platter after observing behaviors that I thought were not in his best interest and not allowing him to follow his own guidance because of my fears of his teen years. I came to realize and remember one day, it was really from a CD download that I listened to, probably for the 100th time, but you know how that is. When you're ready to hear something and remember it, you do. And I put it in my car, and it was everything that I knew but had forgotten. And that is that my son had his own internal guidance system. I taught him about it, but I wasn't letting him use it because of my own fears. And I came into the house that day and I said, Dustin, we need to have a talk, and I'm going to give you your life back on a silver platter. And at first he was very surprised and had no idea what I was talking about. And I went on to explain that I was finally coming around to remembering what I taught him, that he knows his own path if he listens to his own internal self instead of allowing me to try and tell him what he should do, which wasn't working out very well anyway.
So we have to, I guess, accept the fact that all of us have this internal guidance system. I think why we're so fearful is we look around and we see others who have the same internal guidance system, and it doesn't seem to be working very well.
Well, you know, it's our, just to kind of define it, you know, we all know, we call it our heart, our gut, you know, that gut feeling you have. It's the same thing, our internal guidance, our compass. And we all have it, and we have it to the same degree, but we all listen to it and trust it completely in different ways. And some people don't realize that they have one, and they certainly aren't listening to it. And how do we listen to it? We listen to it by feeling good, by finding our alignment, meaning our positive ways of thinking. That is how we hear our internal self. When we have that clutter going in our mind, which is negativity and thinking of all the things that aren't going well, we all know how that feels. It blocks us off from everything that we want and everything that is good in our lives. So that's really the key to tapping into your internal guidance, is finding ways to have better thoughts, finding more ways to feel good so you can hear your messages.
So how do we reach the confidence, our own confidence, to take our children to this very special place, this unique, very unique decision-making place in their lives?
Well, we first have to tap into it ourselves, and that's what I do in my book and my online parenting course, is teach parents how to tap into it themselves, because you cannot teach what you don't know, and you cannot teach what you don't trust. And so our own personal life experience is what is going to give us that trust to be able to teach our children how to trust theirs. Because if we don't trust ours and we don't trust theirs, then we can't teach them anything. So it's really, we always have to start with ourselves, of doing our own emotional work. And like I said, our life experience, as it works out more and more for us, we begin to find that validation in our own internal guidance.
And you talk about the law of attraction. How does that play in all of this?
Well, the law of attraction is the guiding law of our universe. You know, just to give an example, you know, we're all familiar with the law of gravity. We don't think about it. It's absolute. It's going to work whether we even ever give it any energy at all. Well, it's the very same for the law of attraction, which is the larger law that governs everything. And that law states that what you focus on, the energy that you give any subject, is going to be what you get back. You know, I'm sure all of our life experiences have shown us that what we think about, when we're thinking about positive ways and positive people, and that's what we're going to receive back. Is the law states that you will attract what you put out, and what you put out in energy, which comes from how you're feeling, which starts with your thoughts.
And then choose your words very carefully.
Words are very powerful. You know, we start in our heads, you know, with what we're thinking.
Right.
And then what comes out of our mouths is very, very powerful. You know, we can really lift someone up with what we say, and we can tear them down to the ground with different chosen words.
Very well put. And I think we all know when we've said the right things, because of not only the response we get, but just the feel of it. I think we know that inherently, don't we?
We absolutely do. Everything starts with how we're feeling, and I love that you said it that way, because it's all about how we feel. Our internal guidance system is about our feelings. You know, what are we attracted to? What are we propelled toward? You know, those are the messages we're getting, that a certain person, place, thing, experience is right for us. It's based on how we feel about it. That's our internal guidance speaking to us. It talks to us in terms of feelings. Well, we feel good about something, or we feel bad about something, and we either need to find a way to come into alignment about a certain something if it feels bad, or we need to let it go and not choose to experience that. You know, it's really about paying attention to our feelings.
And so we need to help our children to not only understand those feelings when they come, but to trust those feelings?
Yes, we're all going to have the feelings. You know, we have the feelings. We have reactions to everything and everyone that comes into our lives. But do we trust that guidance, or do we go into our headspace and try and rationalize and overthink? You know, our brains can really ruin our beautiful internal guidance messages, because we go into that headspace where it's just all logic, and we forget that the feelings are really the true guidance. And when we start with teaching our children to pay attention to their feelings, that their feelings are valid, and to trust them, boy, if we start that early with our kids, by the time they're grown, they will be masters at knowing themselves, and they will have full access to creating really their best lives.
Well, it makes a lot of sense, and as I'm looking at your table of contents, these are the areas that I'm sure most parents probably have a lot of anxiety over, and you put it this way in Chapter 4, giving kids the power to succeed in school. The next one, letting your kids choose their own friends. Oh, my goodness. Chapter 6, allowing kids to develop their own habits. And
yes,
7.
It's all of it. There are no subjects that are, you know, not a part of this.
Trusting your teen's inner guidance system. So we have to reach the point where through our teaching, our patience, our trust in our kids, which obviously we love them dearly, but sometimes we don't trust their decision making.
You know, it's true, we don't, and we don't agree with what they choose. But, you know, Steve, the bottom line is we don't have to. It's their life path. They are here to create very certain things, and it's up to them to create that path, to learn from their mistakes. It's okay to make mistakes. We learn from mistakes. My children made them, whether I allowed them to or not. And those were their learning moments, where it's in their own life experience. You know, we aren't going to be with our kids when they're grown and gone. You know, starting from college forward, they're on their own. And if they have not learned to trust their own internal guidance, they're not going to know to trust themselves, and they're not going to have all those tools to create their best lives. We want to set our kids up for success, and we do that by letting them practice in the safety of the family, of the home, making their mistakes and finding their way. It's all about supporting and guiding your kids in that kind of umbrella of love, if you will, on creating what they're here to create. It really isn't up to us.
What if your kids have all grown up and even living outside the house, and some of them have a better relationship than others? Is there still hope?
What do you mean hope?
You can connect with those that maybe aren't as close to you as you would like them to be?
Absolutely. And you know how we do that, whether it's our children or any subject, is always holding the highest vision for your child and for that relationship. You know, if we're focusing, I'll just kind of use the law of attraction as an example. If we're focusing on where that relationship is right now and it doesn't feel very good, well, we energetically hold ourselves there, and we hold that relationship there because our energetic world is very powerful. So what we want to practice, and it is a practice because we have our emotions to consider, practice every day seeing your child doing their best, being their best, just in not in your perspective, but in whatever they're living, in being happy and living their highest life. And then picture the kind of relationship you want to have with them, and see yourself doing those activities, see yourself in that easeful relationship. And if you practice that over time, that is what the energy around that relationship will become.
Well, I heard a great saying years ago, thoughts precede actions. And so if you get enough of those thoughts whirling in your mind, I'm sure all the right words and the right body language and the right actions are all going to come out.
Yes, I love how you said that. And that's why it's so important to think about what you want. Have those thoughts in your head reflect your desires, because if your thoughts are reflecting what you don't want and what you're currently living that doesn't feel good, that's what actions you're going to take. That's what you're going to attract on all levels. So we really want to do the easeful practice of thinking about how we want things to be, spending our time putting energy into that, because that is ultimately what we will attract.
We've been listening to Sharon Ballantyne. She is the author of her book, The Art of Blissful Parenting, Teaching Your Children How to Follow Their Internal Guidance. Sharon, what's the best way to get your book?
Well, you can get it on Amazon.com or BalboaPress.com or BarnesandNoble.com.
Thank you so much, Sharon, for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you, Steve, very much. I had a wonderful time.
And this interview is brought to you by Balboa Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Congratulations on being the proud owner of an adorable, soft, cuddly, sweet-smelling, smiling, cooing, hungry, tired, gassy, screaming little bundle of joy. So now what? Where's the owner's manual for this thing? Where are my instructions? Right here. It's Baby and Toddler Instructions with Blythe Lipman on TogiNet.com. Infant care specialist Blythe Lipman has worked with babies for over 20 years and works extensively with new parents, providing workshops, in-home visits, tips, and daily phone calls to ease those frazzled nerves. With Baby and Toddler Instructions, you can get the advice you need on how to survive and enjoy your baby's first year. For more information on Blythe and how she can help you, go to babyinstructions.com. From 32 ways to stop a baby from crying to 14 ways to get a baby to eat and so much more, it's Baby and Toddler Instructions with Blythe Lipman on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world.
The title of the book, Prelude to Genocide, Incident in Erzurum, and the author is Virginia Gavian Rivers, and Virginia joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to you by Archway Publishing. Hello, Virginia.
Good morning, Steve.
Great to have you with us, Virginia. This is a very timely book with all that's going on in the news. We hear so much about Christians being persecuted and even genocide in certain areas of the world, but let me read what you've written. This is based on your family stories. It's based on as much fact as you could find. And this is your statement. A Christian Armenian family survives a massacre because a Muslim neighbor gives them a safe hiding place. Why this happens is a mystery to be solved. So this is the story of your family.
Yes, it is. And it was my father's recollections from what his parents told him that led me to explore the questions that are raised in this. I will say just a little bit about my father. He was born in Russia in 1899, but his parents had escaped illegally from eastern Turkey after the massacre in 1895 in Erzurum. They were Armenians, and so he grew up speaking Armenian at home and Russian at school. He was named after an uncle who was killed in that 1895 massacre, but a neighbor who was a Muslim captain in the Sultan's army, had sheltered the family, had made sure they were in a safe place when that violence broke out. And so the question that the book explores is, how come the uncle was not in the safe place with the rest of his family where he should have been at the time they experienced this violence? The Muslim neighbor was a very, very good friend of the family, and that friendship is pictured and developed in the course of the story. The book I write is told by three different narrators. One of them is the Muslim talking about his life. The other two are my dad's mother and my father's brother, who was a businessman. And so we have three quite contrasting points of view. And the woman, my father's mother, also had a very strong recollection of her escape across the border into Russia following that massacre. This was something else that I use in the book. She had been nailed into a box, as were the children, into other boxes, and they were smuggled across as if they were trade goods. But she said it was a very claustrophobic, horrifying experience, and my dad said she always wept when she recalled coming across the border illegally into Russia.
So we have loyalty, murder, kidnapping, of course, a lot of intrigue. It's a fast-paced story, but it explores these hard-to-answer questions that you're bringing up about the nature of humanity, especially when you have a diverse community. Seems to be functioning in a very cooperating way, but then becomes abruptly violent. That is beyond our comprehension, isn't it?
It's very hard to understand how this can happen, and I think it's very clear from the memoirs and accounts I've read about that time that the government of Turkey was a key player. They still do not admit having had any sort of policy or program that encouraged the violence that took place. And so there is an issue with the Armenians in America today that the genocide in 1915, the big one where we have just had the 100th anniversary, that is still denied by the Turkish government. The genocide that I'm writing about is a smaller one. It was in 1895, 20 years before the larger one. And it seems as if there were just sort of systematic episodes of violence that occurred whenever the army moved from one town to another town and through eastern Turkey, as they did in just a few months in late 1895.
Raises a lot of questions similar to those asked about the Holocaust, that's for sure. From your research and talking with others, I know you went there, right? You visited there.
Yes, I did. Yes, I've had a trip both to eastern Turkey, where I was able to see many of the small cities and little villages, hamlets, countryside of eastern Turkey where the Armenians historically lived, and also go to the city where my father was born. That is Kars. It's now part of Turkey, but at the time my father was born, it was in Russia. It had over that century gone back and forth as clashes took place, and sometimes it would be Russian territory, and it ended up with the settlements of the First World War as part of Turkey and has remained there. But it's right on the border of the present Republic of Armenia. And when our tour bus, I was with a small group, when our tour bus got close to the border of Armenia, we were stopped by Turkish military police, and they wanted to see all our passports, and they wanted the people with Armenian last names on the bus to get off And our tour guide said, no, these are American citizens. You can't take them anywhere. They will not come off the bus. And so fortunately, they backed down, but that happened twice while we were in the area close to the border between Turkey and Armenia. So the hostility between those two countries continues, and I don't think it's a Muslim-Christian hostility, but it is a it is caused by various diplomatic negotiating issues.
That must have been more than just nerve-wracking. You must have been frightened and wondered what was going to happen. With all your research, do you come away with any understanding of why people don't see what is coming and you know, flee to safer places? Why do they stay?
Well, I believe they are experiencing a pleasant life in neighborhoods that may be mixed, so that they have friends and neighbors and interactions with people who, if they are Muslim, with Christians and vice versa. They don't foresee that there should be any problem at all. And so the tendency is to maintain the status quo. Who wants to leave their home and disrupt their lives by fleeing? Now, after this violence in Erzurum, a large number of Armenians did decide to emigrate, as, of course, happened all over the eastern part of Turkey, and some went to other parts of Turkey, but a great many went to Greece or Syria, Lebanon, and even the United States. So it's a problem that you're reluctant to recognize, I think.
Well, I guess we just believe in our neighbor, don't we? We believe that since we have a friendship, even though we may look at life differently, we may have different values, we may worship differently, we still have had all this respect and trust all these years. How could all that break down and become so unimaginable?
Well, I think it does take instigation by a leader who, for reasons of his own or reasons of state, tries to incite violence and will figure out the ways to get the neighbors angry, upset with one another. And then there is, as there was in the Holocaust later, you see that people benefit in some way. The majority gets to confiscate the property. They get to take over the farm or the business or the house that has been vacated by the persecuted minority. And that's so that's a very rather unpleasant aspect to these incidents of genocide. I believe that there are profits to be made by displacing the population that may have been peaceful but is perceived as in some way threatened. But let me talk about more positive things. I found in my research some just interesting cultural differences. The habit in those days was for a family, if they could afford it, to live in a very large group with all the sons bringing, as they married, bringing the wives into the same house. that they had grown up in, and so the matriarch and patriarch of the family would be overseeing the development of their grandchildren and looking after everybody one way or another, but there was a lot of cooperation and work to be done, and you had a very complex family life. My father talked about sometimes having 40 people under one roof in the house in Erzurum, as his parents described it.
Right.
And the patriarch kept a very tight grip on things. He insisted on an hour or more of praying together as a family in the evening, and he said his mother said that if a woman was pregnant, she welcomed it because she didn't have to get down on her knees for an hour or two every evening. She was given a reprieve and could sit on a bench or a sofa. And well, let's see, there were many outings the family would take into the mountains, and trips to visit a hot spring or a monastery hours away. They would travel together and have picnics and have also activities in the city itself. So there was a very nice, rich cultural life for the Armenian community. My daughter and her husband adopted a wonderful little boy from an orphanage in the capital of Armenia, Yerevan, 10 years ago. This youngster is now 10 years old and just a wonderful child, but I had the pleasure of going to Armenia when the adoption was underway and getting to get the feel of that small country. It was very vibrant and interesting, and I realized that if I could have spoken Armenian, I would have been very well off, but the population has Russian as a second language. Oh. not English, so although the people we were with spoke English, it was sometimes difficult in the street if you wanted to buy buy something or find your location to know exactly how to do it.
We've been talking to Virginia Gavian Rivers. Her book, Prelude to Genocide: Incident in Erzurum. Virginia, what is the best way to get your book?
Well, you can go to the website, Prelude to Genocide, Incident in Erzurum. No, actually, the website is just preludetogenocide.com. There is a spot to click on that will connect you with Amazon to order the book, and also with Archway Publishing to order the book, so you could do it either way. And ABE Books and some other places have it. I would encourage you to go to your local bookstore and order it.
Yes.
And they will get it from Archway.
Well, thank you so much, Virginia, for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you, Steve. It's been a pleasure.
And this interview has been brought to you by Archway Publishing.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Do you ever wonder if you're the only woman who runs errands in her yoga pants so it will look like she went to the gym? Or how about the only mom who feeds her kids raw cookie dough? Or are you the only one who cooks her family cold cereal for dinner? Do you need more laughter and less loudness? More self-love and less self-loathing? More joy and less judgment? You're not alone. Come to the living room, a place where we get comfy, candid, and confident together. Come seeking sanctuary and leave feeling renewed. We're saving a seat for you. Give yourself some living room today.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Today I have the privilege of visiting with the former beauty contestant winner, Little Miss Happy Texas, and also the author of a book titled Unstuck, One Heroine's Journey of Art and Courage to Live on Purpose. And joining me from the Northeast is author Vicki Todd. Thank you for joining me, Vicki.
Wow, thank you. That was quite an introduction.
Well, I hope the rest of it goes as well as the introduction then, if you liked it. You have a fascinating story and certainly one that's courageous. I loved looking not only at your book, which is not super long. It's, what, 60, 70 pages, something like that. It's,
right.
It has artwork in it and has your story. Share with my listeners a little of Happy Texas, because that's not where you live right now, and it is a real place.
It is a real place. My family still lives there, so I go and visit. Happy Texas is in the panhandle of Texas between Amarillo and Lubbock. There are 600 and some odd people in the town, and I graduated with 11 in 1984 from high school.
Well, do they object to you calling them some odd, or is that just an expression from West Texas? You said there are 670. You said there are 674 odd people there. I don't know. Happy Texas is a great name, but Happy Texas was not necessarily the outcome of your life. You became married. You were a stay-at-home mom. You had a degree, but then life changes came, and you have done what you call two flips in your life since maybe the late 90s. Share with my listeners why this book got written.
Okay. In 1998, I was in my seventh year of marriage, and it wasn't going that great. You know, it wasn't the best marriage. I had never wanted to have children, and nothing against moms or kids, but I had just always known intuitively that that was not my path. And so in that seventh year, my mom, who had always been a mom and a housewife, really wanted me to have a child. And so we went back and forth, fought about it, and I finally gave in and surrendered. And so I did end up becoming pregnant, but then lost the baby in May of 1998. And I had not been working. My husband was a hairdresser, and so he wanted to open his own salon. And so I had quit working 4.5 years before. And so I was just totally lost and floundering, and many nights found myself on the bathroom floor during the night, just really crying and praying and saying, God, you know, this is wrong. I don't want to be married. I don't want to have a baby. Help. You know, I feel stuck. And literally 2 months later, in July of 1998, I got a call from my former dean at Texas Tech University, and he had seen the feature story that I placed in the newspaper promoting the salon. And he said, hey, you know, do you want to come teach a public relations writing class this summer? And oh, by the way, it starts tomorrow.
Oh, boy.
And so I was just shaking in my shoes, but I knew I had to do it, because if I said no, I would remain stuck. I knew my marriage wasn't going well. I had to get out. This was the key to freedom. So I taught the first class that summer. My dean said, you know, great job. Have you thought about getting your doctorate? No, I've never thought about going back for a doctorate degree. But I did, and that took 4 years. I taught part-time at Texas Tech while I was working on it, got divorced, and then found an assistant professor position teaching public relations at a university in Connecticut. And so I moved by myself in 2003, and that's when I went back to painting. I didn't teach painting. I had always been surrounded by art because my grandmother and aunt in Happy had taught oil painting classes, and they're both artists. So it was there, but I just always saw it as a part-time hobby.
It was in your DNA, because at 3 years old, when you were in the Miss Happy contest, and I actually won that contest, even though there were some odd people in that town, you were asked what you wanted to do when you got older, and what was your response?
An artist. And so it just came out of that little smaller version of me.
Hmm.
So it's always been there. But, you know, you're told, oh, art is a frivolous hobby, do it after retirement. And so I had just forgotten about it. But going through that tumultuous period of going through divorce, going back from my doctorate degree and knowing that I was going to have to move, I just gravitated to art. And I don't know why, because I had never painted on canvas before, but I just started doing these female portraits. And I did my first three before I moved, Inner Beauty Blooming, Defiance, and Sea of Hope. And I thought, wait a minute, you're painting a visual diary of what's happening in your life.
Yes.
So that's where it started.
And you've had, I mean, you didn't start out with formal training in the art world. It just was a talent that was hidden or suppressed. Is that also a way to describe that?
I took probably five art classes, you know, throughout college just as electives, but it was not my degree.
Your book, how would you describe for my listeners the visuals, not only that are in the book, but also the underlying theme that you're trying to convey?
The visuals in the book, I've chosen, I think it's 12 of my memoir visual diary portraits that correlate with the story. I call them memoir portraits because they represent what's happening in my life at certain snapshots in time. So as people read Unstuck, they'll get the story of my two life flips in words, but also there are the portraits that go along with the story in color, so you can really see what they look like. So what I really want to get across with the book is I truly believe we all have a purpose for why we were born and placed on this earth. We all have gifts that we were born with that we're meant to share. And I truly believe, because I'm living it, if you can find out what your purpose is, what those gifts are, and actually work that into your life, you know, you don't have to totally uproot your life and move across the country and, you know, eventually... I taught at Quinnipiac University in Connecticut for 12 years, but I resigned a year ago. I was tenured, and I resigned with no safety net because I needed to follow this purpose of using my art to inspire others to fulfill their own purpose. And so that's the message of the book, is we all have a purpose. We all have gifts that we're meant to use. If you can incorporate them into your life, you're going to be so much more joyful and peaceful and have a vibrant, textured life. But you don't have to go crazy like I've done. You know, you could weave it into your current life now. Maybe one Saturday a month, you know, you want to go volunteer to, you know, help the elderly. Or maybe you want to be a writer so you can, you know, carve out 15 minutes a day to write one paragraph. But if you can find time, your life is going to be so much more joyful for yourself, and it will make the world a better place.
Your book is not just a coffee table book then either. It is actually a motivational book to some degree.
Yes. I have taken my teaching skills. You know, I taught 17 years from Texas Tech to Quinnipiac at the university level, and so that teacher is ingrained in me. So at the end of the book, I have an Honor Your Purpose action sheet that will be four questions to kind of get you started on the road to finding out what your purpose is. And, of course, there has to be an art project. And so, you know, it's the reading of my story, seeing the visual diary portraits, but then also giving you some tips and some of these takeaways to work it into your own life.
Is there a family history of courage and courageous action from your grandmother or mother or other family members?
Oh, gosh. I am the only person in my family who has moved this far away solo.
Right.
But I just think, you know, my father was a farmer and rancher. So was my brother. My brother is the fourth generation on the farm. And, you know, they've always been self-employed. And that takes a lot of courage. You know, that's what I'm doing now, too. And it's scary. You know, it's scary at times. So I think that that entrepreneurial spirit is definitely ingrained in me.
I love the title of your book, Unstuck, because most of us, whether it's me or someone who's listening, have a part of their life that they feel a little bit conflicted about. Maybe it's a decision they've made in the past or one that they are considering for the future. What would you say is a first step in order to get unstuck?
I think if people listening are like me, I really didn't know what my purpose was until the age of 47. And that happened when I started meditating in 2013. So this was a full decade after I had moved from Texas to Connecticut. My art was a forgotten part-time hobby because I was figuring out, you know, how to be a professor. And I started meditating, and Deepak Chopra said, if you could be anything in life, no fear, no obstacles, what would that be? And an artist popped up in my mind. For me, that's how it started. If you don't know what your purpose is, I would say go back to your childhood. You know, look at old photos, talk to family members, and think about what were those activities that really lit you up, you know, made your heart sing, because those are breadcrumb clues to what your purpose is in life.
This book is your own story, but is it similar to other books in the marketplace, or do you think it has some uniqueness to it and maybe some motivational messages that need to be told?
I think it is similar in the fact that there are books out there that talk about, you know, following your purpose. I think with my book, what makes it unique is, you know, I've just been crazy enough to flip my life twice. I have, in addition, after I finished Unstuck, I went and taught in a little mini workshop and did an art talk at an art center in Redmond, Washington. And the next day, the lady who founded it and asked me to come to that organization said, we have, you know, I'm stepping down as executive director. Would you like to step into that position? And so I'm leaving at the end of May from Connecticut to move to Washington to do that. So I think that's what makes the story unique is my courage, my ability to become unstuck and just kind of go with the flow. I also think that the message about surrendering to the process, which is not easy for me. You know, I'm not a patient person. I want things to happen now. But surrendering to that flow of the universe is so important. And also listening to your intuition, that inner voice, not your ego voice that is scared and fearful, but that intuition inside. For me, meditation helps me really tap into that. But that can show you piece by piece the next right step. And so I think by telling my experience with those things, with the art, that makes Unstuck unique.
On a personal level, as a child, were you ever described as hyperactive or hyperkinetic?
Not necessarily hyperactive, but my mom has told me a story several times when I was probably 2 years old and trying to work on a puzzle. And I was stuck, you know, with the puzzle. And she said, would you like some help? And she said, I said, I do it myself. So I think I've had that stubbornness all
that's
along.
That's a good thing. That's a good thing. The title of the book, again, is Unstuck, One Heroine's Journey of Art and the Courage to Live on Purpose. Wonderful subtitle. Vicki, my listeners will need to get a copy of your book. How do they do that?
Oh, great. Yes. They can go to my website if you would like a signed copy, and it's Vicki World Art, V-I-C-K-I, World Art. .com, or you can go to the BalboaPress.com or Barnes & Noble or Amazon.
Absolutely, and they can go to their local bookseller and request it by name, Unstuck, and under the author's name, Vicki Todd. Vicki, is there another book in the future, or is this just the beginning or the ending of your story?
This is just the beginning. I already have a contract for a second book in which I want to interview other artists and talk about their story of following their purpose of being an artist.
Great. This sounds like a fascinating study that you'll be engaging in. Hope to visit with you again. The title of this book, again, is Unstuck. My author, Vicki Todd, has joined me from Connecticut, and next time, who knows where she'll be. Thank you again for joining me today.
Thank you.
For Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.